Hey, Larry.
Hi, Andrew.
How are you tonight?
Doing fantastic. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
It is. It was beautiful weather here, too. Low humidity, breeze blowing, all that stuff.
You actually have blue skies in the Peach State?
Yes, it's a beautiful day. Couldn't ask for better weather. I even got out and mowed the grass.
Grass in early March?
Yeah, it's starting to come up to the point that you got to cut it. Yes.
All righty. Well, we had a beautiful blue day here, blue sky day here as well.
If you like the podcast and want to support us, visit patreon.com/registrymatters to contribute. Even a dollar would be great. You can also find the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn, or your podcast app. So this first article is from The Spokesman. While his brother is in prison for molesting another child, he comes out with allegations that he too was molested by his brother many years earlier. Now that his brother is about to be released after serving 25 years, he is saying that, "I want that son of a bitch to never see the light of day." So we've talked recently about statute of limitations and who represents the victims and so forth, or who represents the defendant. And this is akin to, you know, the mom saying that, you know, that guy molested my kid and he should never get out of prison. But there's a guy, he spent 25 years in prison. His brother doesn't have any say in the matter. I don't even know that he should make the news.
Well, he did. He made the news. So this red dust that comes out of Idaho, and the issue is he is eligible for release. He was sentenced 25 to life. So he's done the minimum 25, so he's eligible to be considered. So this is the process by which the parole board's going to consider. See, Charles Manson was eligible for parole as well. He never was granted it, but this guy is eligible to be considered for parole. So this is an accusation, which his brother makes no bones about it. It's deliberately intended to keep him in prison. He's making him this accusation all these years later. And he doesn't want him. He says he wants him to stay until he dies. So he does announce his motivation, and that's to keep his brother in prison.
And is there a problem with that?
Well, I would have to know more about Oregon law in terms of who's allowed to be heard and considered the parole board. Traditionally, it's victims of the case that put the person in prison. But as we've seen in Michigan with the Olympic doctor, with the gymnast doctor, a lot of people were allowed to testify that were not a part of the case. So if he has standing, as it's called, to as it's referred to, if the parole board will consider what he has to say, they could. I mean, perhaps they will consider his sort of request that his brother stay in prison. But if it's not permissible under the rules, well, yes, it's a problem. But if it's permissible, I guess. The only problem is that it's permissible, and maybe it shouldn't be.
So even though he doesn't have anything to do with the case, and he's coming out with an unfounded allegation, I mean, he's just saying it. So there's no necessarily any evidence that he did do this to his brother. So how does he have any sort of standing with the parole board or anybody to advocate against him?
Well, in a perfect world, he probably wouldn't have any standing, but I don't know if he does have standing under Oregon law. And when you say there's no evidence, there is a shred of evidence. That's his accusation. That is
okay.
Evidence. There's no corroborating evidence. But as we talked about in a recent podcast, other than a sex offenses, we do require evidence other than the accusation. And I did the analogy a couple podcasts back about an internal embezzlement, and I wish I had used a different example. Would be like domestic violence. We don't allow a victim of domestic violence to come in 25 years later and say, "He pummeled me." When officers go to investigate a domestic violence, they look for evidence of the violence. They do take the victim's statement, the alleged victim, but they look for evidence that will support that. They look for bruises and broken dishes and broken windows and listen for neighbors who've made noise, heard the noise that they were making, they heard pictures falling off. I mean, they do look for some corroboration. So, but in sex offenses, we don't seem to care about whether there's any corroboration. And 25 years later is an awful late report for a person to make for this situation. I'm not in favor of it, but apparently he's made the accusation, and perhaps he'll be his brother will be prosecuted for a new for this late report.
Well, that's what I was going after, though. Is I mean, I realize his statement is evidence of itself, but that in other types of cases, just the allegation might be enough to get the cop to write some sort of statement, take a report on it, but that doesn't do anything beyond that. And then they would go look, like you said, to see if there's any bruises on the victim, or is there other evidence around, broken, something or another, that something went down, something happened. But here it's just this one dude, his brother, saying, hey, he did that to me 25 years ago. Or it's not even necessarily 25 years ago. It was longer than 25 years because he's done his 25 years in prison. But there's nothing you could do with that.
There's absolutely no way that this could be a fair trial for if criminal charges were filed. And that is the problem with these late reports that result in prosecutions. We would not allow it to happen in other crimes. We wouldn't allow decades later for, like I say, domestic violence is a better example. That's an underreported crime, just as significantly as probably as sexual offenses are underreported. It's within the same roof, the same familial structure, and you have situations where people can't report it. And it goes on at some levels, sometimes very significant levels, and it goes unreported. But 25 years later, 30 years later, Those cases don't move forward. So it's unfortunate, but the right thing to do, as far as the public is concerned, if there's an accusation of sexual misbehavior, the heck with due process.
There's a science geek that I follow. His name is Lawrence Krauss. He's actually the head of the organization that moves the doomsday clock, and you know, moved it forward. I think 30 seconds. We're like 90 seconds to midnight right now, something like that. And he has been recently accused of inappropriate things with ladies at conferences. Hey, come up to my room. I heard that he pulled out a condom. Like, she thought he was up there to talk about science, things about the conference, whatever. And he starts making those kind of gestures. So, and now, in the court of public opinion, he's a scumbag. He's been uninvited from conferences and other speaking engagements, just because, and I'm not saying that the women's accusations aren't credible or shouldn't be heard, but we've already convicted the guy because some people said some things about him that's inappropriate. And I don't know how to balance that out, because you shouldn't believe them, but you shouldn't not believe them either. And I don't know what the middle ground is there.
Well, I think the middle ground is the middle ground we take into other criminal accusations. We look for evidence to support the accusation. You do a thorough evidence. You assume that it's not true, and you assume that it's not false. You take a neutral position, and you look for evidence to support the accusation. If it's an embezzlement, you look for evidence to support it. If it's a domestic violence, you look for evidence to support it. If it's someone claiming that they were a victim of an assault, you look for evidence to support the accusation. That's what you do. That's the middle ground, as you look for evidence to support, because it's the duty on the prosecution to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And without evidence, you have a difficult time meeting that burden, unless you just simply say no evidence is required for these type of crimes other than the mere accusation. That's dangerous if we stay in that posture that we're in, where no evidence is required other than someone's alleging it.
From My Fox 8 in Greensboro, North Carolina, there's a clip there of a police officer who's been invited into the school for like a, like, what's my job day kind of thing. And there's a clip there of the cop coming outside and talking to the newscaster. And he said, if you take your eyes off of your kid for just a second, they'll disappear. And then we will have a situation. He's blatantly, like, right to the camera, saying that stranger danger is a real thing, and that if mom and dad take their eyes off the kid, they're going to be snatched up by the nearest perv, and you're going to lose your kid, and they're going to be on America's Most Wanted. And maybe I'm making it a little too extreme, but that's kind of the message that I got out of it, that they are totally promoting the idea of stranger danger.
Well, they do promote that idea of stranger danger, but in that particular clip, I didn't view it with quite the same that he necessarily meant that was the only way kids disappear, because kids do disappear when you turn your back, and they disappear because they wander off, and they have energy, and they don't know the boundaries, so they disappear all the time. Well, how many times have you heard of when they have the tag you're taught at the state fair and stuff? I mean, kids do disappear.
Certainly.
But
they don't go anywhere. I mean, they might go around the corner. They go out of your sight and mom and dad freak out. But they don't get far.
Generally, they don't. You know, they're reunited. But that is where we are in society, is that we that's why I sit back and look. I think I mentioned it, one of our podcasts about when the last time you've seen an adolescent riding a bicycle. You know, that was our path to independence when we were growing up.
Exactly.
We would ride a bicycle. But we've so terrified people that the kids are so unsafe that a bicycle is unheard of. I haven't seen an adolescent riding a bicycle in so long, I don't even know if they still sell adolescent bicycles.
I go into this frequently, that I want my kid to go out and play, my son. I want him to go out and play with other kids in the neighborhood, but there are no other kids out to play in the neighborhood. So it's not like you could just kind of assume that if you ride your bike down to the corner or wherever you guys would hang out, that there would be other kids there. So if I send him out on his bike, he goes out and he's like, well, I came home because nobody was out. That's because they went out, nobody was out. And it's just this vicious cycle, because mom and dad want their kid to be safe. They think that something's going to happen. They're going to skin their knee. They're going to get into trouble. They're going to get abducted. I can't imagine when I was his age, well, a little bit older than his age, me and my friends, we would ride our bicycles up the street to about a mile away to the local shopping center, and we would go throw quarters into video games just for hours. Go have some pizza, hang out, go to the arts and crafts store, and then come home a couple hours later. Mom and dad just said, be home by the time the streetlights come on. End of story.
I recall those days. It's too bad, because the truth is that the kid is safer now than they were when you and I were coming along growing up. The technology for tracking kids, there's very few adolescents running around that are not carrying a cell phone. I don't think I've seen one in the last recent memory. And even young kids are running around with cell phones. So they've got all these tracking devices. We've got cameras recording. There's nowhere you can be in public that there's not a camera rolling. You notice every time there's a law enforcement investigation, video surveillance was retrieved from all the different angles of all the businesses that are on the strip. So wherever the incident is, there's the gas station, there's the bank, there's everything around the Winchell's donut, you name it, there's video. So the kid is safer now. They could be out doing these things, but we've convinced parents that their kids are in grave danger if they leave their sight. It's sad. Take a look at a yearbook from 2017, and compare it to a yearbook from 1978. Pick high schoolers, middle schoolers, any yearbook you want to, and compare it with those four decades, and do the ratio of overweight students, and count the page. And if there's 25 students on a page, count in the 1978 how many were overweight, and then compare it to 2017 and see what you come up with. It's pathetic. You see that the kids, even in elementary school, before they would even think about being old, I think the last statistic I saw was about 25, 28, approaching 30% of elementary students are overweight.
That's not legislated. That's not just the media campaign making people feel unsafe. The moms and dads have gotten together and gotten legislation, either at the state, local level, whatever, so that Lenora's blog is pretty thorough in this department. Maybe we should ask her to be on to talk about this. That, you know, kid, like, there can't be monkey bars on a playground, or they can't have gravel. It has to be this soft something landing material. There's all kinds of like city ordinances or stuff like that to quote unquote keep your kids safe so they don't scrap their knee, whatever. It's silly. It's ridiculous.
It is indeed, and it's sad, because our kids are growing up less prepared to deal with the world when they become adults. They're less healthy, and they're less from not having the experience of growing up. It's tragic. There's more to it than an Xbox or whatever you call those things that kids sit around and play all day at home so they can be safe.
And I'm a big advocate of video games, because they do teach things, like they'll teach strategy, or they will have some sort of social element to them where they're communicating or team playing with somebody else. It's not just a complete wash. And I mean, it's certainly better than just watching television, which doesn't engage you at all. But we should go over that once. And because I was listening to something they were talking about, that there is absolutely no correlation between kids playing violent video games and the school shootings. There's no correlation between it.
And did the video game industry sponsor that research?
I don't know. I don't think it did, frankly. I think it came from, I'm with you though. Because that would be like the tobacco industry saying, oh, smoking doesn't cause cancer. All right, that's fine. You're not biased at all. From the intelligence, Pennsylvania State has started the process of removing as many as 5,000 ex-offenders from the Megan's Law Registry under the state Supreme Court mandate and a new law. So this is something similar to you guys covered it on the NARSAW call earlier this week. I know that they signed a new law to keep a certain class of people on it, but they even somebody in the chat that night was saying that they are removing people. And I don't think this article is that old. This article, it's a few days old. But still, they are removing people off the registry according to the way that the Supreme Court shut that thing down.
Absolutely. What happened, for those who are not familiar with Pennsylvania, is in 2010, they
was
went
it 12?
Solidly. Well, I'm telling the story.
Oh, okay. My bad.
In 2010, they went solidly conservative, and they threw out all their progressive leadership. And they elected a Republican governor and a significantly Republican Senate and House. And they passed a law to change the registry to come into compliance with the federal standards. And they went beyond the federal standards, but they adopted what they called the Adam Walsh Act in Pennsylvania. And it took effect December 20th, 2012.
Gotcha.
It gave them time to so the election was in 2010. I believe the act passed in 2011. And it took effect December 20th, 2012. So my point is, elections have consequences. What they did is they took people where Pennsylvania did require 10 years of registration, and they took them to 15, 25 in life under the tiered structure of the AWA. And then they took offenses that had not previously required registration, and they required them to register. So what you had is people who were in any point of a 10-year track. They could have been in year one, or they could have been in year 9.5 of a 10-year track. And on December 20, 2012, they all of a sudden became subjected to a new registration regime, which required either 15, 25, or life. And if it was a 25 or the life, their frequency of reporting went up. And then there were people who had been making negotiated pleas with the state for offenses that didn't require registration. And they were told, as of December 20, 2012, you have to register.
Right.
And that wasn't a part of what they bargained for. So all the people that will be coming off, since this cannot be applied retroactively because this version of registration is too punitive, that it no longer can be deemed a civil regulatory scheme, all those people that were in a 10-year track are going to be put back into a 10-year track. And all the people whose offenses did not require registration are going to be back to their offense not requiring registration. So there'll be a lot of people coming off. There were people. It took from 2012 to 2018 for this to fully resolve itself. So there were a lot of people that would have been continuing registering that their 10 years would have expired. So you're going to have a lot of folks come off as a result of the Pennsylvania decision by the Supreme Court and Commonwealth versus Muniz. But then the legislature decided that they didn't want to just have no registry at all, because effectively this declared no registration. Because the law was declared unconstitutional, there was a question about whether, if they were in year one of a 10-year track, if they would have to register at all. So they did this House Bill 631 to make sure it's clear that there will still be a registration requirement, but it'll be less onerous, and it'll be more like what they had in what they call Megan's Law 3.
Okay.
It's going to essentially put people back to the previous version of the law.
You can't give me any examples of what made it too onerous.
Retroactive.
Okay. You can't give me any examples.
Sure I can.
Okay.
I can. The frequency of reporting, having to go in four times a year versus once a year.
Okay.
It made it more like probation. And having a life term. made it you had a constantly moving goalpost. Now, I don't know that they require anyone to register beyond life. I mean, I've never heard of anybody complaining about having to report. So I think that's about as far as you can go.
Okay.
Is requiring someone to register for the remainder of their life.
Yeah, sure.
But the primary thing that made it punitive was the constant of more frequent reporting than was previously required. It was more like a probation scheme than a regulatory scheme.
And as with all of these things, they say in the interest of public safety, we need to know where these people are four times a year instead of just once.
Well, and I could buy into that, but why do they have to come in person? They can tell you where they are. They can tell you where they are electronically.
I signed up for new auto insurance online yesterday. Went through the whole process online. That was pretty onerous as far as the information that I had to give them. They did a pretty deep dive credit check, all that stuff for me to switch over my car insurance. Why can't the local police do something similar?
Well, they could, but the law hasn't been passed that mandates that. Absolutely. You could report all your update information without ever going in.
And I mean, even your driver's license, it's like a 10-year kind of photo thing, at least in Georgia. So, you know, maybe you do go in there on occasion to update something like that, right?
Well, I mean, you can update photos. You don't have to go to a passport office. You can ship your photo to
fair, fair.
Trust me, they can compare it with the previous photo. And
right.
It's not you.
Yes.
They have, but it's because they. Part of registration is to humiliate.
Right. Doesn't that in itself call it under challenge to make it?
Well, it does. It does. Those points haven't been argued as eloquently as they can or should
okay.
be. But I intend when we do our New Mexico challenge to raise those points of the humiliation. When you go to something that's supposedly a regulatory scheme, you shouldn't be reporting to a police officer.
Right. You should be going to the DMV or something of that nature.
You should be going to something where it's clearly that they're in the regulatory business. So I will push very hard to move it out of law enforcement because, after all, it is a civil regulatory scheme. And, of course, there are podcast listeners out there that are just about ready to shoot whatever they're listening on because, clearly, it's not a civil regulatory scheme.
Yes.
But those are arguments you make to try to get what you want, which is a less onerous registry. They're not going to abolish it. But if you didn't have to report to people who had guns and all sorts of weaponry, if you actually reported to the place where you find it a lot less intrusive, which I don't find going to the driver's license office, maybe a little bit of line there sometimes, but I don't find that to be nearly as obnoxious as going to a sheriff's office and waiting to be booked.
Right. It's certainly not intimidating. Yes. And fingerprinted, all that stuff. Yes.
But yes, there will be a lot of people in Pennsylvania that will. The unfortunate thing is, there's two unfortunate things. Unfortunately for people, they won't realize that they need to stay put in Pennsylvania because they're only off in Pennsylvania.
Right.
So a lot of folks will move and they'll find themselves back on the register again because they'll think they timed out in Pennsylvania and that's binding and it's not binding in any other state. And then the people who have been committed crimes and been convicted subsequently to 2012, this has not been challenged on their behalf. It could be that it's punitive as applied to them.
Right.
But that challenge has not been made yet.
And we're going to get into that pretty heavily about those challenges.
Chip away further. Sounds good.
All right. So down in my neck of the woods down here, this guy is kind of scary. I didn't catch the author's name, though. But, I guess I have it right here. The author's name is Bill Crane. In response to the recent school shooting, the author of this article seems to conflate being on fire with stranger danger. He says that we should regularly drill students on safety procedures for lockdown and active shooter scenarios. Our youngest, a child with developmental delays, is well aware of stranger danger, as well as the particulars of stop, drop, and roll. Require monthly lockdown drills tied to the receipt of state or federal grants to improve school security systems and staffing. The title of the article is We Must Prioritize Our Protecting Our Children. This guy is also heavily, heavily, heavily in favor of that if you take these shooters, the ones that are still alive, and kill them, execute them, that this will then make the school shooting stop. This guy is scary.
I read the article and I couldn't I couldn't find that it was easy to follow. It seemed like he was struggling with reality in some regards on the issues of the stranger danger. I mean, that there's just no stranger abductions at a school.
That's just going to be one of the last places it happens. That would be like going to a school dance and trying to abduct a kid. There's 500 other kids around and parents everywhere, or try and abduct one from Disney World. That's also not going to happen.
Well, it was bizarre because I just can't remember the last time that the stranger danger or where there was a child abduction at a school. There may be propositions made when people are driving along seeing someone that they think is hot and may say, "Would you like to hook up with me?" But as far as someone grabbing a young child, it's just so rare that I suppose that if we had unlimited money, we could spend a whole lot of money on doing these preparations. But it seems like that there would have to be some evidence that there's a need for. I mean, we've got the evidence we need to prepare for lockdown situations for school violence, because that's happened from state to state. I mean, there's a fair number of those incidents that have occurred, from Kentucky to Colorado to Florida. I mean, to you name it. There's New Mexico. We had a shooting here just in the last few weeks in Four Corners area.
There was the Texas church shooting.
But to prepare for something that just doesn't happen. I don't understand where he's coming from, but when he said the stuff he said about the death penalty, I do kind of know where he's coming from.
But the reason why I bring up these articles is not that I'm trying to support their agenda. I'm trying to bring out that this is what we're fighting against as far as what public opinion is getting. That's where they're getting their information from. So people here in Southeast Georgia, they're reading this thing and they're perhaps saying, right on, man, that stranger danger thing. Kids, you can't go outside, because as soon as you step outside, someone is going to snatch you. And that's what we're fighting against.
It's tragic, but he wants the big bad federal government. Apparently, the way I read the article, did you read it the same way, that he wants the big bad federal government to mandate that?
He did talk about something like, yeah, I mean, he wanted federal grants tied to the improved school safety and staffing.
And it's interesting because he seems to align himself politically based on this article, that he's very conservative. And normally people that are of conservative persuasion claim that they don't want the big bad federal government mandating, because the states are far smarter, far more in touch with what's needed on a local basis. But amazingly, he's advocating that they mandate expenditure on funds or something that's just really, there's a minimal, if almost non-existent need for teaching kids about stranger danger and having a school drill to protect from something that doesn't happen at schools.
So help me out here. In where would the federal government get money to give the states? Where would that money come from at its source?
Well, obviously it comes from the various revenue streams that the federal government has, which there's a number of them. They get a big bulk from federal income tax individual, and some smaller amount from corporate taxes, which is a much smaller amount than what it used to be. And yesteryear, we levy excised fees. There's a bucket of revenue sources that fund the government. Payroll taxes for reporting Social Security, but it comes largely from the people.
So, but three of the four things you just said were tax related.
For visiting national parks.
Uh-huh. Three of the four things you said were tax related.
Right.
So this is, I don't even want to say the word. I'm going to get tomatoes thrown at me. This is socialism, because if you want to take money from state A and give it to state B, that's socialism. Is it not?
Well, I don't know if that's the definition that commonly is described socialism, but.
If you're taking from a group to give to another group, if you're balancing, if you're having a level playing field, that is, you know, the taxes in Europe are so high to provide that huge social safety net that they have there. And this is, you know, I mean, it's tailored to a specific thing, but it's very similar. If we're going to take money from Montana and give it to Georgia so that they can have a safe school system, we're still taking money from Georgia to give it to Montana for their safe school system.
Well, theoretically, states would have equal opportunity to access these funds, I would think. It would be a national safety program, I would hope. So theoretically, Georgians and Montana schools could access this. But but my point was about the mandating that by the federal government.
Yes.
I mean, do you realize all the screaming you get about the mandating curriculum, mandating the Obama administration took all the heat about the mandating a balanced, nutritious diet to try to cut down on the obesity and childhood obesity and unhealthy children.
Type 2 diabetes.
Well, we don't need the damn federal government telling the local schools how to feed their kids. Of course, they already have the option. They cannot tell the kids, the local schools. All you have to do is feed the kids yourself using your local funds, and the federal government has no say in what the lunch menu is. But since you have your paws out to the federal government saying, we're not capable of feeding our own kids, we don't consider that a priority enough. We want the big, bad federal government to do it. That's the way they have the cable and their string to attach to the requirement that you have certain nutrition, healthy, nutritious meals. But how can a conservative advocate for this? Because that's supposed to be contrary to what conservatives believe. That was my point, is that he seems to be of the conservative persuasion, but he's advocating that the big, bad federal government mandate this.
I understand.
You'll find out as you go through life, Andy, analyzing people, they are four things. It's like socialism. You will hear a lot of criticism about subsidies, but the same people that hate subsidies love them when they're flowing their direction. And
yes.
I do an analogy about urban mass transit.
Yep.
Conservatives hate urban mass transit. They say that, by golly, mass transit, if people want to ride mass transit, it ought to pay for itself. Of course, they don't say that about highways.
Right.
But you do that same analysis about rural post offices. The Postal Service was looking at a significant number of closing of post offices a few years ago.
Yes.
Because they're supposed to run a balanced budget.
Mm-hmm.
And all these rural people who don't believe in subsidies, they magically were in favor of subsidies because they said, well, you can't close our post offices, even though they don't generate any revenue, because that's how we get our medications and that's how we stay connected to the outside world. And we're 20 miles from the next town. We can't go to the next town to pick up our mail. It's okay that the urban dwellers subsidize our rural post offices to keep them open. They do the same thing with the Essential Air Service. That's a service where smaller airports wouldn't have airline service.
Yes.
And the government subsidizes Essential Air Service, and that primarily takes care of rural areas, small areas that tend to be very conservative. And they're all in favor of the subsidies for Essential Air because they say, well, if you won't have any air, we'll be disconnected. Well, I thought you believed if something was economically viable, it would self-sustain itself. And if you don't have enough business for the private sector to provide the air service, you shouldn't have air service, right? That's your philosophy, right? You don't believe in subsidization, but magically they do when it comes to a subsidy that they're. You can go to rural electrification. You can look at rural telephone service. You can go across. They're all in favor of it when it suits their purposes. This is kind of off topic, but we have to be intellectually honest. We're in favor of socialism when we're the recipient of what there is to offer. We just don't like paying for social programs.
Right, and when you're not receiving it, you don't want to pay for it when your neighbor gets it.
That's apparently the case. We don't consider we're in this together.
What?
That we're healthier as a society when people have healthy lives. We benefit when more people are healthy, working, productive citizens. The model works a whole lot better if you don't have an underclass in your nation. And the Europeans have figured that out.
Shouldn't people pull themselves up by the bootstraps?
We have developing and growing in America. Well, I think it's in the modern era we're living in, that's a lot more difficult than it was in the 1700s or 1800s.
I've just heard that argument made. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, which probably the expression there on its right there should tell you what time frame it was used.
Well, there was a time when you could do that, when we lived in rural America, and we lived in an even industrial, pre-industrial time, when you could go out and cross the country and go to Wyoming and hire them with a ranch, and they didn't care about your past. They cared about whether you could herd sheep or cattle or whatever they're herding. But that's not the modern America we're living in today. You have to have skills. You have to be able to function. You have to be able to compete in a modern economy. And people who are dysfunctional, we've got a lot of broken individuals in our country.
Yeah.
And they may be broken by choices that they've made, but they're broken individuals, and we're leaving them behind.
And should we help them get back up to some level of parity and production?
I think we benefit as a society from that. I don't see any other way that we don't. I don't see how we benefit from having a bunch of Hoovervilles, for those who don't old enough to remember or haven't studied it, in the Great Depression, all the encampments that sprung up because we had 25% unemployment.
Oh, okay. I know what you're talking about.
America. Yeah. So we had people living a bare threat existence. And I just don't think we're healthy as a nation. I don't think that if you look back in that era that people thought we were very healthy as a nation, and we're not going to be healthy as a nation if we continue to let this underclass grow of dysfunctional and broken people.
You know, speaking of that, we have a pretty modern example when the fracking industry really started ramping up. I'm probably going to get the state wrong, but I want to say it was North Dakota, had a massive influx of people. 30, 40,000 people moved into these areas that have no infrastructure. And now you've got typically a guy going out there to do very, very hard labor, maybe married, may have kids, family follows along. And there's nothing there for them to do. There's no school system. There's no shopping malls. There's no movie theater. There's nothing for anybody to do. There's barely a place for them to eat. And that would be almost identical, if you want a modern day example of what these Hoover Dam little encampments were. And they were horrible living conditions. But that in itself, so now you've got a guy out there making pretty good money, probably, you know, 40 or 50 bucks an hour doing this really nasty labor. But his family has no support structure. So where do the kids go to school? So now maybe a group of moms or something like that get together and they start doing a homeschool. But those kids are going to have a challenge where there's no identified curriculum, perhaps, sheltered, and so forth.
Well, the big difference in the Hoovervilles and the people back in those days had no income.
Mm-hmm.
At least these people do have, when they've gone to these states that are in boom times that are not prepared for the boom time, they at least have an income, but they don't have the benefits and the structure of a modern society. They're not prepared for what we would consider the basic necessities if you don't have doctors and you don't have schools and you
exactly
don't have, it's a relatively primitive existence in a modern era. You've got money, but things you need.
Yep. All right. So moving on, and this is from a website called The College Fix. A student activist publicly called me a rapist. A student activist publicly called me a rapist with no evidence. Here's the toll it took on my life. And in this article, the individual who was accused had his name listed on a website with 35 other people, and his read rapist. And after that, then word gets spread. Then as he walks down the school campus, people are moving out of his way. Or he starts having psychological issues about being shunned from his little community. And again, similar to the story we just covered a little bit ago, this one is even, I mean, you know, the other guy from Greensboro, at least that, not Greensboro, it was from Iowa. That one, the guy, his brother was already in prison. So there's at least there's history of it. So here's some kid, he's 18 or 19, whatever years old, he's in college. And he gets accused, and his whole life is being thrown down the tubes because of an allegation. I'm not saying we shouldn't believe the girl. She just says that she got terribly drunk and didn't know what was going on. Fine. Bad decisions. Everybody makes bad decisions. But good grief, man. Don't throw somebody else's life down the tubes.
So, well, the way I looked at that article was that the person who started the website was not even the accuser. It was another person who started the list of the his name appeared on.
Right.
Did I get that right?
No, I think I'm just confusing. I think I saw two articles on the same subject. One of them I actually saw the girl that made the website. Anyway, I'm complaining. I'm confusing two articles, but go on.
So, here is an example of where we have technologies ahead of our case law. Before we had the internet, your blacklisting somebody was a lot less achievable.
Right.
I mean, you could go print up posters and handbills, and you could go around and take a staple gun and put them on poles on campus, and they would be wind torn, and they'd be torn down, and maintenance would take them down. But in this age we're living in now, you don't need to go through that effort. You can simply create your own site, and you can say ugly things about people that lack substantiation. And the case law hasn't caught up with what we would do about it, because we're trying to balance between the person's right to speak and what are the consequences of saying something that may not be true, and what consequences should you bear. Well, I'm hoping that the case law accelerates in its development, because people that are making these accusations, if they start feeling the consequences of making false accusations, unsubstantiated accusations, I'm hoping that case law develops. Now, there'll be people out there listening that'll say, well, apparently he's for the rapist. No, I'm not for the rapist, but I'm for due process of law. And it's not good to call someone a rapist and destroy them when they have not been accused in a formal way. There's been no report with the police. There's been no investigation. There's been no formal charges filed. It's not good to ruin someone's life. He is not a rapist. He may have committed the act. We're in no position to know that.
Right.
But he has not been adjudicated as a rapist.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't deserve this to be happening to him until such time as he goes through a formal process. And I'm about due process. And he is not getting, and those people that student that got that list, these guys have not been afforded any due process.
Not at all. I'm glancing through the article a little bit more detailed at this moment, and the guy says, I've had 5 sexual encounters in my time. I've always asked consent questions such as, are you comfortable? Is this okay? All of them willingly came to my room and gave me a verbal affirmation that they wanted to have sex. So perhaps someone is going home having the infamous walk of shame the next day, and now they're like having some regrets, sexual remorse, I guess you could call it. And then they post up there that the guy did things that you didn't want done. I'm with you, Larry. We can't believe either side. We can only take them at face value and then go through our legal process to figure out who's right and who's wrong.
So, well, I don't know what else. If you've gotten permission, I don't know, perhaps, but see, then you can't run the video, because then you have the right to privacy coming in. Did a person have the expectation of privacy when they were engaged in a sexual? So then they get you for video voyeurism,
right,
or some invasion of privacy issue. But this is tragic. But he's considered suicide. He's
right.
Had suicidal thoughts.
So what
and
about
a student killed himself at the?
What about doing some sort of contracts? You know, some sort of written consent to sex. I mean, this is ridiculous. You shouldn't. This is ridiculous. But I don't know how else you protect yourself.
I don't know that that's very feasible. I mean, how many written contracts have you made?
Not like that, but how many other things do you do that have this level of consequence? If I say, hey man, let's go out to dinner, I'm not going to have you sign a contract that says we're going to go Dutch. So you. Typically, when you meet someone and you are going to go have relations with that person, you don't enter into a contract with them. It is a verbal contract, correct?
I suppose it is, yes.
So, I mean, I guess in one respect that you have already entered into an agreement with the person to do whatever you guys have agreed to do. I don't care what you've agreed to do, but you've agreed to do it. So how do you protect yourself? This goes to something Trump has been running, saying the entire time of his campaign that he's going to quote unquote open up the libel laws because all these lies about him in the media. Okay, well, if somebody makes these accusations against you saying that you're a rapist, that is incredibly inflammatory and defamatory. I don't think that's a word.
Defamatory. Well, so, Well, I'm reading this article, and it says that the student, Elizabeth Dunn, created the list. But
right.
She's not claiming to be the victim of this guy. She's
right.
just got his name from hearsay.
Yes.
And added him to the list.
Isn't that so defamation of character?
That's what I was saying about it. I hope the that the laws evolve, that simply taking Dunn's secondhand accusation is completely false. And this is his quote. As I've always made it priority to listen to each of these five sexual partners wanted to do. So she's not claiming to be the victim. She's claiming to be that she's protecting people by creating this list of things that she's heard. Way to go, Ms. Dunn. Elizabeth Dunn, job well done.
And last, before we get into our kick-ass subject of the night, this is actually a publication I've been following a little bit lately. It's from the National Review. And the author says, let them wear bracelets. Instead of unconditional release on bond or parole or probation, use GPS monitoring with a cell phone. An argument is made in the article that the Fourth Amendment claims will be raised. And reading through it, the cost, and I was thinking when I was reading it that they weren't going to bring up the cost of prison versus how much it would cost to monitor somebody this way. And they did do it. So they used Florida, and they said it's about $20,000 per inmate, whereas doing electronic monitoring would cost $3,000 a year. Since they brought up that piece of it, I was concerned as I was reading through it. This is a fairly right-leaning kind of publication. I don't see a problem with this one. This would make a lot of sense to me to take people that you can release out on the street, but you still need to keep an eye on them. You could set up geofencing on where they can and can't go. And now you have positive confirmation of where these individuals are.
And that's the problem, your reaction, that's the problem we have with these things, to how they grow to be what they are. if it were that simple.
Okay.
But it isn't. What you have happened with these is you have an exponential growth of people who would normally be under standard probation with reporting in person, or they would be released on a cash or surety bond, and they wouldn't have any other conditions attached to them. What you have is the universe of people under supervision grows.
Right.
It's not an either or situation in most cases. So you don't get the benefit of the savings, because you still have your prison full, but you mm-hmm. have people who would have been less structured without the GPS. The way to go into an urban setting, you might not see it so much in Houston County, where they might not be fully integrated with GPS in the pretrial setting, but go into an urban setting, go into Fulton DeKalb County, and look at how many people are released on GPS as a condition of pretrial. They're released on that. Now, in the old days before GPS, they would have just simply posted their bond or been released on their personal recognizance and told to report to a pretrial officer once a month, or to call in every week or whatever. But all of a sudden, they're being assessed these costs for their pretrial supervision that they wouldn't have had to pay in the old days. And the jail is still packed, but you've got a new universe of people who are being supervised. So I would agree with you, if we just simply move people out of the prison, if we said, well, we got 10,000 in prison and our goal is to reduce the prison population to 7,500, and let's pick the 25% lowest people and put them out. But that's not what happened. You still have the 10,000 in prison, and then you have another 2,500 or 5,000 who are out in the community having to raise money to pay for these costs. So it's not, it doesn't work out the way it's sold.
It's not a zero-sum game.
No, it doesn't work out that way. So I'm for using it as an alternative
right.
to incarceration. So if I'm a judge and you've been accused of a crime, and I say, well, there's no set of conditions I can release you. I would not ever consider personal recognizance based on your history. I would not ever consider a small cash bond or surety bond with your condition, because I don't think that I can trust you to respect boundaries. You've got a problem that you have not been able to deal with. So the only way I'll let you out of jail is if you agree to this GPS. That's an appropriate use of it. But if you make it your policy that everybody who's on pretrial release has to be monitored, and that's what happens. it becomes an additional requirement of people who are bonding out. And when you're released pre-conviction, you're supposed to be presumed innocent. And the only deprivation of liberty is enough to assure your appearance and that you don't continue to threaten the community. So pretrial supervision with GPS monitoring may not be necessary and probably isn't for a significant number of people that are accused of crimes. They don't need that level of supervision, but they get stuck with it and they have to pay for it. So I don't quite buy into the National Review. This was the National Review, right?
Yes.
Yes. There's a big business out there of GPS tracking, and this is being pushed by them as an alternative to incarceration. But it doesn't turn out to be an alternative. It turns out to be in addition to incarceration.
I understand your point. They did say in there, I'm not sure where it is at the moment, but they did say for pre and then parole and probation.
Yes.
So what about on the backside? If the option, I see where you could then make the same argument then, hey, well, we can release these 25% of the people. We can then fill it back up on the other side. But if they could let 25% or 50% of the population go and put them on some kind of monitoring, to me, that sounds like a win, but I understand where you're going to go. I think I predict where you're going to go.
Well, I agree. If it's a win, if we're actually releasing people who otherwise couldn't be released, like for the guy that we talked about earlier, for that was being considered for parole because he's done his 25 years.
Right.
It might be a very good device to make sure that he doesn't go to areas that are completely inappropriate for him based on his criminal history during that period, because his parole, I'm assuming, since he was sentenced 25 to life, I'm guessing that he would be under parole for the remainder of his life.
Right.
So it might be appropriate for him because you could take care of him in a less costly way and probably provide a substantial amount of protection to the community. And I know that there's going to be a person say, well, of course they could cut it off. They go, yes, they could. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. They could. They could do that.
But that also incurs penalties. And generally, it is a known thing when they do cut it off, right?
Well, yes, you have a fairly quick warning when it's been removed and tampered with. So
right.
they don't get a lot of lead time.
Right. So, you know, maybe they have 60 seconds, maybe they have 5 minutes, something like that. Or if there's enough time that they could take it off, take a 10-minute shower or something like that, however that situation goes down. But yeah, I see where you're going to go as far as if it's in addition to, then no way. But if it could be instead of, then the person ends up back in the community. They can go back to work. They could get back with their family. I can't find really any negatives of it with the people that you would be otherwise willing to release, but you just don't have the support structure in place to monitor them effectively.
Well, it's become an alternative to actual supervision, the old-fashioned way.
Right.
Supervision, supervising officers have used it as a lazy way to gather intelligence.
Right.
Just slap a GPS monitor on them. Well, in the old days, you went out and spent a little time getting to know your offender, and you figured out where they were going. You might have to put a surveillance team on them to figure out certain things about their life, but you knew what they were up to. Oh, well, let's just strap a GPS. I mean, I don't know if you've ever worn one, but they're not all that comfortable.
No. Well, and this is talking about GPS, like a phone one. So you're just carrying around your cell phone and occasionally 4 or 5 times a day it calls in. You take a picture of your face and you say some sort of code word into it. And that mark, they have your location, they have your voice, and they have your picture.
So there's no attachment to the person on this one. I didn't catch that.
Not the person I know that has one.
So well, that would be a lot less intrusive.
Correct.
The ones that they attach on your ankle, they rub you raw. They're,
yep.
You have all sorts of problems with them. They're too tight. They're too loose.
Definitely. Well, Larry, you ready to talk about judges?
Well, I sure am. But people who want to contact us, they need to know how to contact us.
We'll run it. Tell them how they can contact us.
Well, they can contact us by a number of ways. I'm going to start with the old-fashioned way. If there's anybody out there that uses a phone, you can call us at 747-227-4477. That's 747-227-4477. And for the most of the people who would not ever think of using a phone, you can email us. And that's registrymatterscast@gmail.com. registrymatterscast@gmail.com, or the website, registrymatters.co.
So let's talk about judges. and what their specific purpose is in the process of identifying if a law is unconstitutional. And a pretty well-known example that I had completely wrong until you set me straight is when Trump came into office, he initiated the travel ban. And I was hoping you could shed some light on where I was wrong. I just assume a judge woke up and said, no, Mr. President, you can't do that. I say no, but you say I'm wrong.
Yeah, it doesn't happen like that. There has to be a complaint filed. So in the case of the immigration, there was a number of complaints filed by different organizations and state attorney generals, whichever way that goes. There were complaints filed all over the country. And so when a complaint is filed, then that's when the judge can intervene. And the complaint was filed, and they sought emergency injunctive relief, which is a very high burden to meet to show that you're entitled to that relief. For a court to grant an injunction to stop a law or a policy, to stop something, there has to be, you have to establish that when this case finally goes to trial, that you're likely to succeed on the merits with existing case law that's already out there. And you have to show that without the injunctive relief, that you're going to suffer irreparable harm. It's a pretty tall order to meet. So getting an injunction is not an easy thing to do. But injunctions were granted because they were able to show that they were likely to succeed on the merits. And by and large, they've been succeeding on the merits. he's been stopped on most of his travel ban efforts.
But can you used a couple terms in there, the legal threshold terms that you used, and they've slipped my mind. Injunctive order, is that what you said?
An injunction is a prohibition of something. A court can issue an order that prohibits the law from being carried out. So it's an order to hold the status quo. So when the travel bans were announced, the first one actually took effect, and people were stranded at airports that were not allowed to enter that had already been en route and their airplanes because it was so haphazardly implemented. An injunction is nothing more than from a court prior to the case going to trial on the merits saying we're going to hold the status quo. So the government was enjoined from implementing the president.
And so the way that I've always heard our government described is that it's like a three-legged stool where you have the judicial, executive, and legislative branches all working, I don't know if you want to call it, against each other or with each other to push and pull against their element of power. So the executive branch, the president, said, this thing is going into effect. An organization challenges it through the court system, and the judge says, no, I'm stopping this. So does an individual judge have as much power as the president, or is it them collectively have as much power? And I don't mean president, the executive branch, whether that's the governor or whether that's the president.
Well, the judge, if there was jurisdiction for the subject matter that was brought before the judge, in this case, it was federal judges, and immigration is a federal issue. So presumably there would have been jurisdiction of the court. So the injunctive relief is nothing more than holding the status quo. So the president could ultimately be right, but the judge felt, based on the evidence and the existing case law, that the complaining party was going to prevail on the merits when this case eventually is resolved. So that was nothing more than holding the status quo. So I hope that helps. The president may be determined to be right when the case eventually works its way through the appeals court process, which is ultimately will be the U.S. Supreme Court. The president may turn out that he had the authority to issue the executive order, but the lower level judge didn't see it that he thought it was offending the Constitution.
You thought the judge thought that the president's order was offending the Constitution. And so it may make its way all the way up to the Supreme Court, probably will. And the president may prevail, but the judge stopped it. So what is the judge's role in determining what is the stance that he takes? What position does he take as far as determining whether that order is constitutional or not?
Well, it's a temporary stop. The case has to be tried on the merits. So there will be a full-blown trial on the merits. This is only a temporary pause.
Mm-hmm.
So when the case goes and is decided on the merits, it may be that the judge may reverse himself and say, well, actually, having heard all the evidence, the president clearly has the authority to do this. There's no discrimination. There's no constitutional issues. People from outside the United States have no right to come to the United States. People that have family members of the United States have no right to be connected. I mean, it may be that that's the way it ultimately is decided. But the judge's role was simply that, based on what was presented to the judge, that he didn't see that this was going to withstand the constitutional challenge when it eventually goes to trial. So it was temporarily halted. But that's not a permanent halt.
You bring up the idea of controversy often in talking to me, that there have to be, you can't, somebody can't sue the government without having an affected party. There has to be, I don't remember the words you used to describe
standing.
It. Standing. Thank you.
Legal standing.
So somebody has to be affected by the thing in place. That means that person has standing. They have some sort of skin in the game. That's how they get represented. That's how they then file a claim against another entity. Doesn't necessarily have to be the government, but it could be a person. So now you have people that have some sort of controversy, right?
That is correct. That is correct.
So then you have the two attorneys duke it out. What is the role of the judge in dealing with the duking?
Well, I compare it to a referee in terms of one aspect, that the judge is the referee in terms of deciding the law. There's two parties arguing about what the law says and about how it should be interpreted. And the judge is enforcing the rules of the game and making sure that ultimately the parties have played by those rules. And then the judge determines who made the most compelling arguments. And it's supposed to be based on the rule of law, not the judge's personal opinions. Not judges are human. And I can't say that personal biases don't come into play in their decision making, but that's the judge's role. In an athletic event, the referee takes a proactive measure. When the referee sees something and it's an infraction, the referee calls it on their own. In the court system, that's not exactly the same. The referee, the judge, usually waits for an objection.
Right. I was just about to bring that up.
From a party. So it's not exactly the same. So the judge will hear a statement and consider a statement unless a party objects to its relevance or its admissibility. So it's not exactly the same role when you're refereeing football. When somebody grabs the face mask and pulls the person down, the referee doesn't wait for the other coach to come out and say, "Did you see that, ref?"
Right. They throw a flag.
"I object to that." The referee does his own objection.
But in a court system, if one attorney
legal
is
system.
Go ahead, Larry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's a jousting contest more in the legal system. The referee is in a jousting contest. The referee is letting them joust until somebody objects.
And if you have an attorney that's leading the witness, berating the witness, whatever, if the other attorney never says anything, I mean, I guess a judge would eventually be like, "Look, man, you can't do that." But otherwise, they can do that all day long unless the opposing attorney says something.
Well, there are extreme examples. The judges can control their courtroom.
Right,
they can,
right,
right. They can act sua sponte, which is without an objection from either side. But that's less common. Judges tend to let the parties go forward. And they say, "We're professionals, and if there's something that's not admissible, we can sort that out." And if it's a bench trial and not a trial to the jury, the judge will just say, "I'll disregard that. I know I'm not supposed to consider that." But it's far more problematic in a jury setting because the untrained citizen juror doesn't know what was admissible.
Right.
And once it gets in there, it's hard for you to tell a motion to strike, Your Honor.
Yes.
The jury will disregard that. Well, really?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
How many people disregard stuff they've heard?
It's pretty hard. I mean, once you've heard it, it's kind of hard to unhear it. But I wrote this down. I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to put this in there. And if you look at the professional sporting teams, the difference between the capacity of a team between the two, I got to think is negligible. But you could have an all-star attorney on one side and just a worthless scumbag on the other side. And that totally changes the outcome. And you could have that working in your favor or against you. If you have no money, perhaps, and you have a real shit attorney, you have crap representation, even though you may be innocent or guilty, whichever side of the coin you're on. The other side has a rock star attorney, and they are able to win the case against you or for you just based on them being a rock star or a scumbag.
That's certainly within the realm of possibility. It happens all the time. People have varying degrees of representation. What do we do about it? That's the question.
Well, I know on the public defender side, I mean, they're not, if they were a rock star attorney, unless you just have really super altruistic insights, you're going to go out in the public sector and you're going to make $250,000 a year. Why would you sit in a government office, make $50,000 and have 400 cases on your load versus going out and making the big bucks and eating high on the hog and living in a big house?
So, well, that theoretically affects both sides, though. The same thing can be said for the prosecution side, that you can become a prosecutor and make similar salary, maybe a little bit better than the public defender, but you're not going to live high on the hog. So theoretically, in a criminal setting, the prosecutors would be. I mean, you see what I'm saying? The same argument be made that the prosecutors are not the cream of the crop. But I tend to believe that it's a little deeper than that. The problems we have with our inadequacy of the public defender, I don't believe it's so much the quality of the attorneys. I work with them all the time, and I don't believe it's the quality of the attorneys. They're good, and there are some that are not as good. But the problem we have is just simply more the resource issue,
right?
The crushing caseload.
Yeah.
The fact they can't visit with their clients, they can't strategize, they don't have budgets for expert witnesses, they don't have the same resources the state does. The state has enormous resources because they run the gamut of all the law enforcement. I mean, think about all the law enforcement entities you have in your state. You have the state, the federal, the local, and you have all these resources available to you that you can call upon. On the prosecution side, you don't have to pay for. The public defender can't do that. He needs a psychosexual evaluation. He's got to pay for it. He needs to go have an accident reconstruction expert. He's got to pay for it. The state puts forth the theory that the accident was caused by you. They've got their computer expert that diagnosed whatever you call that thing in the onboard of the computer in your car. And they say, this is how the accident happened. This is what our expert says. If you want to counter that, you have to have an expert. Where do you get those funds?
Right.
So the attorney that's representing the injured person doesn't have those resources.
Right. And the state can just call upon them, but the defendant has to pull them out of pocket.
That is indeed a major challenge for the system. So I think that if we equalize the resources, which that would be mean people would have to pay more in the way of taxes, and I know that's a taboo subject in America, but we would have to be willing to fully fund the indigent defense system, and that would be tough to do. And the defense system is the only component of the system that has no control over the caseload. Prosecutors can control how many cases they file. The judges can make cases go away when time schedules are not met. But defense attorneys can only make cases go away by pleading them out. That's the only way they can make them go away.
And we've kind of moved off from judges into the defense system. Does a judge necessarily care about the facts of a case, or do they care, or does it matter about the attorneys involved?
Well, if you're talking about it in terms of the trial level for guilt or innocence,
yeah,
we were talking about constitutional challenges earlier. But if you're just talking about a run-of-the-mill case, the judge is supposed to be focused entirely on the facts of the case. That's supposed to be what the judge is focused on. But they're also human beings, and that's why we need computers to make all these decisions, according to some, because
where are you going with that, Larry?
Judges have their favorites. They have people that they're impressed with. They have people they're connected with outside of the courtroom that I mean, I think it would be dishonest if I said that personalities don't impact decisions that are made from the bench. But the judge is supposed to be concerned about the facts and who's proven facts and who hasn't, which depending on who's bared the burden of proof and what that standard of proof is. If it's a civil case, it's a lesser standard. But the judge is supposed to be deciding if the burden has been met based on facts and the evidence has been presented.
I guess where I was going with that particular part of the comment was that the jury is the one that's interested in the facts. The judge is just playing referee to make sure nobody plays an unfair card, I guess, like leading the witness or whatever that is. They are the umpire. They're the ruler of the court just to make sure that things don't get out of hand. But ultimately, then, even the facts of the case are decided by the jury, unless it's a bench trial.
Well, I was going to say the overwhelming majority of trials are tried to the bench.
Are they really? So they're not jury?
Most cases are resolved without a jury, but the trials, sure. there's a huge number of them that are bench trials.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
But if you wanted to clarify the question, the fact finder is either the judge or the jury, depending on if it's a bench trial.
Okay.
And of course, if it's a jury trial, then the judge is less concerned about the facts. The judge is more concerned about making sure that the rules have been followed and the jury is instructed on what to consider as a fact. And make sure the jury is properly charged with the understanding the burden of proof, the presumptions of innocence that's supposed to follow the person. So they get all these instructions. You're not to draw an inference from the fact that the defendant didn't testify. There is a presumption of innocence that follows this accused person all the way through your deliberations. In order to convict this person, you have to find by beyond a reasonable doubt that within Bernalillo County, New Mexico, that on about this date that he did X, Y, and Z as charged in count one. And if you don't find that by reasonable evidence beyond reasonable doubt, it is your duty to acquit. I mean, the judge does that part when the jury is the fact finder, but the judge is often the fact finder as well.
So to circle back around to the constitutional side of things, I want to say it was an attorney said today, many legislators often say, we don't need to determine if a bill is unconstitutional because after it becomes a law, eventually someone will challenge it in court and the courts will do their duty and judge the law. And we spoke earlier about all three branches when they get sworn in, they affirm that they're going to uphold the Constitution. So shouldn't they go into something when this legislator goes to propose a bill, sign a bill, vote on a bill? Isn't there some sort of dialogue that they go, is this constitutional or not? Doesn't then the executive branch look at it and go, is this constitutional or not, before it should go to a judge? I mean, shouldn't there be stopgaps along the way to prevent things that are obviously unconstitutional from making it to the point where somebody has to try it?
Well, that those things do happen. I mean, I'm in the legislature all the time, and those discussions do come up. When bills in committee, lawmakers and advocates will say that we have trouble with that. We don't think you can do that. It's not constitutional. So those deliberations do occur in the legislative process.
But we've covered articles here. The one I'm thinking about is where there was some change to gun carrying laws and then something similar with a notification element. And I'm not saying this is necessarily constitutional or not, but the hypocrisy of it saying that if we're going to look at this group and say we're going to do it for this one, but not do something identical to another group, it's dishonest.
Well, what's constitutional is subject interpretation. So in order to find those boundaries, sometimes you have to pass a law because you truly don't know. Legal minds can disagree on what's constitutional. I refer to the late Justice Scalia. He said that the right to bear arms was not absolute. And he was asked in the interview, well, what's the limit? And he says, we don't know. He said, we'll have to wait till the cases work their way up to us, and we will let you know at that time. So in order for anything to work its way up to the Supreme Court, someone has to pass a law to restrict guns and try to see how far they go, just like the people that are against abortion. Since 1973, they have been trying their best to find and succeeding in some cases on passing laws to restrict abortion because they said, well, abortion's not an absolute right. You don't have the right to an abortion under Roe versus Wade. It's not an absolute right. So they've tried to do parental notification. They've tried to try to say after the 18, 20 weeks, you can't have an abortion. They've tried to raise the standards so that, they have to, that the abortion providers have to meet very high standards, which makes them shut their clinics. And they have to do them in a hospital setting, which is more expensive. So each time a law is passed, there's always a challenge that follows. And the courts say, well, nope, you cannot do that. And yes, you can do that. So sometimes you actually need to pass a law to figure out where the limit is in terms of I'd like to know what the limits of guns, because those who claim that they're originalist and that there's no evolving standards and nothing changes from colonial times, well, then to take them under their doctrine, you would have the right to own weapons consistent with what the founding fathers would have thought of as weapons.
Bring out the muskets.
And I can assure you that what we consider today to be weaponry that people have the right to own, the founding fathers never envisioned people owning these type of weapons. But I bet they'll abandon that original doctrine when it comes to guns and say, well, but of course society's evolved and technology's evolved, and of course we should be able to own the more modern weapons. But wait a minute, you said in terms of the death penalty, you said that we should interpret cruel and unusual punishment to be exactly what the founding fathers thought of it. And they didn't think of the death penalty as being the least bit cruel and unusual. It was quite common used in the time. So their words on those precious papers and documents meant exactly what they should be interpreted, exactly what they meant at the time. Well, then let's just stay consistent with that. You have the right to own weapons consistent with what the framing fathers would have thought of as being weapons. To me, that's a consistent interpretation. But of course, no one would buy into that because society has evolved and all the weapons we have today, they would never have dreamed of in colonial times.
So what do we have to do? We have to pass a law that says you can own a bazooka and then somebody go off and challenge it? Or they say you can't buy a bazooka and somebody say, damn it, I want to own a bazooka and I challenge it?
We have to do it the other way around. You have to pass laws to see what people can't own. And then the court will take up those challenges as they work their way through the court system, and we'll find out where the limits are. Scalia said there are limits. I mean, we don't know where they are because we can't get past the NRA to pass anything to find out, because it's just something we're paralyzed to do anything. We can't even agree that universal background checks.
Right.
Although we've had the background check system for some time, we can't even agree that people all should be subject to it. There's amazing ways to get around the background check by buying from an individual or buying from certain gun shows. So you can avoid the background check that's supposedly universal. And we can't agree to expand the background check. So we can't even have a discussion about what guns might be, which, if any, guns might be too far to go. So the courts will never get to interpret it because the laws will never be passed.
Yeah. So I also have in there about the different levels of, what are these, the rational basis, intermediate scrutiny, and strict scrutiny. Is there a reason to go over those, or should we wait? We've been going for an hour and 20 minutes.
Probably we ought to just focus mainly on the rational basis test. That's the lowest standard. And most challenges end up being reviewed for simply a rational basis, that the legislative branch have a rational basis to do what they did. Was it admirable that they wanted to curb speeding? Is it admirable that they wanted to reduce highway deaths? Is that a rational thing to want to do?
Sounds rational.
And if what they stated as the purpose is rational, then the actual legislative act will survive at that level of scrutiny, because it doesn't have to be that the result is consistent with what they stated. It doesn't have to be the most efficient way to do the goal. That's for you to decide when you vote for people, what's the best way to achieve the goal. You can slow down traffic by a number of ways. You can put officers out and give people a lot of tickets. That's one policy you can have. You can have speed humps. You can do roundabouts. You can put flashing lights. You can put cameras. You can do a whole lot of things to slow down traffic. So merely if you pass a law that says we're going to have within the city limits, no speed greater than 35 miles an hour, that's a rational thing to do to keep your pedestrians in your city safe. And what you do to keep people at 35 miles an hour is entirely up to the individuals in that town to decide how they want to go about doing it. And it's not for the judge to come in and say, well, you know, I don't really care for the roundabouts too much these days because it seems to create a blind spot. And I read a research piece somewhere or another that when you're making that roundabout, it confuses people. And then that's not for the judge to decide. You elected those people who made those policies. And if you don't like the policies they've made, you need to elect different people for the legislative branch. And that's what our people don't understand. Often our people vote for the folks who make policies that are totally inconsistent with the policies that they say they want. But they vote for them anyway because for whatever the reasons are, we could probably spend a whole program on why they vote for people. But our people vote for folks. But I always like to quote U.S. District Judge Richard Koff in the District of Nebraska. And he said when he ruled to uphold the bulk of Nebraska's sex offender registry changes that they made effective in 2010, he said, in a democracy, we have legislatures to make public policy choices, and a black robe does not legitimize nullification of those legislative decisions simply because I find them dumb or distasteful. It's not the judge's job to save you from bad policies.
His only role then is to see if it goes across those different terms, the rational basis and so forth, to see if it would violate some constitutional privilege. Constitutional right to see if
Correct.
It should be stricken.
It's the challenging party has the burden of showing that they've crossed that line, whether it be racial or whatever the First Amendment, whatever the allegation is, you have to show because the legislature is afforded great deference. That's the branch of government that has the broadest input.
Right.
It's the legislative branch. You're representing smaller groups of people. There's hundreds and thousands of elected officials that work in city councils, county commissions, boards of aldermen, selectmen, whatever they call them across the country, to state houses of representatives and state senates, the U.S. Senate, U.S. House. Those are the people who have the greatest connection and contact with the people. And you elected these people. If you're angry at them, don't reelect them.
Mitch McConnell said we don't need term limits. We don't need term limits. We have elections.
Well, and to some degree, I agree with him. You've got the ability to limit everyone's term.
Right.
Under our existing system. But the federal judge that got criticized in the 2016 campaign, Consuelo Curiel, who handled the Trump University case, he made a similar comment just last week. When he allowed the border wall to go forward, and those who don't remember that there was a criticism by then candidate Trump that said he was Hispanic, that he could not be fair to Trump University, and that he should recuse himself, which he did not, and ultimately Trump University settled. But Curiel ultimately said that the border wall can go forward, but he made note that as judge, he cannot and does not consider whether underlying decisions to construct the border barriers are politically wise or prudent. That's not his job.
Right.
So his job is to say, is there a constitutional issue here? Can the U.S. build a wall on its border if it chooses to do that? And I would think it probably can.
Sure. I'm sure we have other kinds of walls, whether it's a simple little chain link fence or whatever. We don't have to, it doesn't have to be a 30-foot wall to raise everybody's hackles. So sure, we can protect our border however we want to.
So it's not his job to determine if there's a better way to do it. We don't know what the environmental degradation may be. I don't know if we've done enough impact studies to figure out how much wildlife will be disruptive in terms of migratory patterns. I don't know all that stuff, but that's not for the judge to decide. we elected folks in 2016, and they told us that they were going to do a wall, and that's who we elected.
I got nothing else.
Well, then it's a pleasure to be with you tonight. And we appreciate, as always, the comments and the support of everyone. And I tried to go to Patreon to sign up myself, but there was not a $10,000 option. And I found that very discombobulating.
My mistake. I will make one. I lift it at $1, $3, $5, and $10. I will put in the I guess I'll call it maid. Well, I'll put in the maid title for the $10,000 a month option. Was that annual or monthly?
I think annual would be sufficient.
Okay. All right. So I'll make a $1,000 a month option out there.
But yes, we appreciate the comments and the support, and we hope that we provide information and get provoke thought, and hopefully we get feedback from people that we provoke thought, and if we've got something wrong, as I've said before, tell us that as well.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Larry. I really appreciate it, and I hope you have a good night.
Thanks, Andy.
Bye.
Bye.
Have a question? Send an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com or leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. You can also leave comments on the website, registrymatters.co. This is episode 14. Music is Downtown by bensound.com. If you like the show, please share it with someone. We would appreciate it if you did. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.